Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Early voting for the March primaries is underway. Voters are deciding who they want to see on the November ballot, and in some instances, the races are highly contested within one party or the other or both. At the same time, there are races in which your vote in the primary will decide the outcome in November. And in this midterm election cycle, there are some very important races, including that for United States Senate. Non-presidential election years often suffer from low voter turnout, but so far, nearly 100,000 votes have been cast statewide, and early voting runs through February 28th, with the actual election day being on March 3rd. With many opportunities to vote remaining, we spend this hour looking at key races, at the races which are highly contested, at some which are not, but because of their significance, increases the importance of your participation in this primary. We're joined by WFAE political reporter Steve Harrison and by Colin Campbell, Capitol Bureau Chief and political reporter for WUNC. Thank you all for being here. Good morning. Welcome back.
Great to be here, Mike.
Good morning.
Good to see you. Steve, the numbers keep changing, obviously, a little more than 100,000, because yesterday, as of yesterday afternoon late, 133,000 votes had been cast. That's up from 91,700 some on Sunday. And as of Tuesday, which is the latest figures I have from Mecklenburg County, they report 13,691 ballots. That's up 7,400 from Monday. So they're describing turnout as steady and strong. Would you agree with that, and how does that compare with other midterms we've experienced here in the past?
Yeah, I think if you compare this primary so far compared with the 2022 primary, the total number of people who voted by this point is significantly higher. You were seeing a greater share of Democrats in the voting pool, and you were seeing more people request a Democratic ballot. You know, remember, unaffiliateds can pick either one, and just because we have so many more Democrats, it's about 58% of the ballots that have been pulled have been Democratic. And if you go back 4 years ago, it was an even split. So when you look at the early voting so far, it looks very similar to the early voting in the 2018 primary, which was, of course, a big year for Democrats. And I think with the feelings, you know, there's so much anger on the left and in the Democratic Party toward President Trump. I think this is shaping up. This is just looking, just kind of another sign that this will be a big Democratic year.
Yeah, Colin, as of Sunday, and that's the latest figures I have, and as I say, because things are changing so quickly, these numbers are wrong, but Democratic ballots counted for 41.5% of the votes cast, Republicans for 29.3%. Is it just anger over Trump? Is it anger over Trump by Democrats? Is it Democrats just itching for change? Is it independents who are looking at what's happening and perhaps they voted Republican last time, we were saying, this is not what we voted for? What's going on here?
We've got a few pockets of the state where there's an interesting Democratic primary, most notably we'll talk to this, I'm sure, a little bit later, the House primary against Carla Cunningham in Charlotte, the primary against Congresswoman Valerie Fouché up in the Triangle, where people are just upset with their Democratic representation, either not being far enough to the left or not being forceful enough in their opposition to what's happening from Republicans. But I think generally speaking, you know, a lot of the state doesn't have these particular marquee races on their ballot. These are certain pockets of the state. And I think generally there's just a desire to participate, to do something, even if it is a primary where you're only voting for people within your own party. And there may not necessarily be a huge decision to make, a huge hotly contested race. A lot of it's just the act of going out and voting and participating and having a say in the future of the country when everything, you know, is going on that, you know, perhaps you're unhappy with.
Steve, the fact that more people are asking for Democratic ballots, because if you're an independent, you can choose, is happening at the same time that for the first time in history, the state has more registered Republicans than registered Democrats. How significant is that? How do you explain that?
I think that the shift in voter registration, in one sense, it's a really lagging indicator, right? A lot of this are people who have, when Republicans overtook Democrats in registration earlier this year, a lot of that was kind of codifying earlier voting patterns. Democrats who have voted Republican for a long time, Democratic voters tend to be older, they die, they're taken off the rolls. So I think that's part of it. So that's like a small trend, you know, in the tens of thousands of voters that we see. But I think just the overall political environment is a much bigger factor. And so, as Colin said, you get a lot of Democrats who just want to go and participate. They just want to be heard. And then the flip side of that is, I think you do, there are a fair number of Republicans who are not enthusiastic. And we've seen in the 10 years of Trump that when Trump's not on the ballot, you know, his coalition just doesn't really rally and doesn't come to the polls as much as when people get to vote for him.
Colin, when you look at the group of independents who get to decide which primary they want to vote in, do we know whether they lean one way or the other, most of them? Or, in other words, are they independent because they want the opportunity to pick and choose the primary? But are they really Democrats at heart or really Republicans at heart? Do we know?
I think there's probably a few, and those are the people that will sort of sometimes decide close statewide races in the state who sort of bounce back and forth between voting Republican or voting for Democrats. And those folks are registered and affiliated. But I think that's probably a smaller percentage of the overall pool. I mean, unaffiliated is the most popular registration choice in the state. And it's not because we have, you know, a third of our state that's super independent minded politically. It's that you have that extra advantage of you can choose when you go to a primary like this one, which ballot do you want? Do you want the Democratic ballot, the Republican ballot? In some places, you can even choose a nonpartisan ballot if there are only nonpartisan races and you don't get to get in the partisan stuff at all. And the other reason to do that, I think, in this state is that your voter registration is very public. I can look up anybody on the internet right now and see how they're registered. Are they a registered DR or unaffiliated? And I think if you want to keep your politics under wraps from your neighbors, from your friends, from your coworkers, registering unaffiliated is probably the way to go.
Yeah. You mentioned young people, Steve, that older people tend to vote Democratic and they're dying, and that young people tend to vote Republican. That was certainly the case in the last presidential election. I think it was young men who played a major role in bringing Donald Trump back to the White House. But then I'm hearing that because the economic problems in the country have not been solved, as he promised they would be on day one, and because young people today are struggling to make ends meet and don't see any way that they're going to be able to buy a house, they're struggling to get married and have families, etc., that young vote is looking for another choice, and that choice, the only other choice they have, is the Democratic Party. Is there a way to determine at this stage what young voters are doing in this primary?
So I guess I'll back up a quick second. And I think what I was talking about earlier was that not so much that older voters vote Democratic, but that in this state, many are registered Democratic. Okay. And so many of them have been registered Democrats for decades, but have probably a significant number have voted Republican for a long time. When we go back to younger voters, younger voters traditionally the Democrats have won them in the 2024 election. Republicans did much better than anyone thought among young voters. And then to your point, Mike, because people still feel upset and dissatisfied with the state of the economy, I do think Republicans it's going to be a challenge to keep that coalition together, just as it's going to be hard for them to keep some of that working class African-American voters who migrated over and Latinos. I think that's going to be very difficult coming up in the fall.
We have a number of races for which the primary vote will decide the winner in the general election because there's no other candidate running against them in the other party. And I'm curious, Colin, whether that suppresses voter turnout because people think, big whoop, or it encourages voter turnout because you're actually voting for the winner in the primary.
I think that's one thing that pretty savvy voters who are looking at the more down ballot local races, whether it's for the legislature, or for a county commission race or city council or something of that nature, you know, that certain areas that is the deciding vote. You will not really have a real choice if you were in Wake County and trying to pick your county commissioner, district attorney in the fall, because there may be a Republican on the ballot, but in a deep blue or deep red county, the primary really is where the action is. So I think some people realize that, but at the same time, a lot of times those are further down ballot races, and sometimes the average voter, I think, is going out there and maybe looking at the ballot for the first time and realizing, oh, I don't know who any of these people are, and didn't realize that they were running or what the choices are in these races.
The big race on the ballots, on all ballots in North Carolina, obviously, is the race to replace Tom Tillis, the senior senator from North Carolina, the Republican who is retiring from the Senate. And in both the Democratic and Republican races, there are front runners, no incumbent, but some challengers. But really, the names that we can mention are those of the front runners. Tell me about this, Colin. It's been a very quiet race. I can't name the other candidates.
The U.S. Senate race on the Democratic side was pretty well decided, in, at least who the primary nominee was going to be once Roy Cooper, former governor, jumped in the race. That pretty much caused every other candidate who was either in or thinking about in to drop out. But you do have, I think, four or five other names on the ballot that are not people who are running serious campaigns. So if you're researching your ballot, like, oh, I don't know who these people are, I should go look into it. They're not serious candidates. They don't have a serious chance of winning. They're not really campaigning even. You may not even find like a website for them. They're people who wanted to pay a filing fee and see their name on the ballot. Let's just put it the way it is. On the Republican side, it's a little bit more interesting that you do have Michael Whatley, who's got the Trump endorsement previously with the Republican National Committee, originally from the Gastonia area. He has two opponents that I don't think are probably really in a good position to beat him, but it will be interesting to see how many Republicans decide that they're not necessarily down with Trump's pick and vote for Don Brown, who's an attorney who sort of cut his teeth on defending the January 6th defendants or the rioters on January 6th, and is sort of positioning himself as further to the right than Michael Whatley. The same for Michelle Morrow, who many know was the superintendent of public instruction candidate for Republicans, who unseated the incumbent superintendent of public instruction in the Republican primary and then was defeated in the general election, but has some very extreme views on that side that raised some eyebrows. So she's in there as well. I don't know that anything can beat Whatley, who has the Trump endorsement, but it'll be interesting to see how many of the sort of Republican grassroots folks decide they don't like Whatley and cast a vote for one of these two.
But because we have this high-profile race that affects every voter who goes to the ballots, no matter which primary you're voting in, Steve, is that accounting in part for the higher-than-normal, perhaps, voter turnout? We have a Senate race?
I'm going to say I don't think that's what's driving more people to come to the polls. I will go back again just to this very basic idea that there are a lot of Democrats and unaffiliateds who are very unhappy and they just want to go be heard. Even though, as Colin said, the Democratic primary for Senate, it's a nothing burger. Roy Cooper will win, but people still just want to go out and stand in line and vote and be heard and participate. I think that's the biggest factor behind that.
Some say the Senate race in North Carolina could end up being the most expensive Senate race in history. How much are they anticipating spending? Has that spending begun during the primary season? Are they holding off until after the primaries? Which party, Steve, is likely to spend more? And where will they be putting that money? Clearly, it won't just be on TV anymore.
I think a big thing to watch on election night will be to kind of look at how much money comes into North Carolina. I think a key thing to look at will be some of the other races nationally. Like if you look at Texas, and if the incumbent Republican John Cornyn loses to Ken Paxton, Republicans are going to be very concerned because they see Paxton as a candidate who is going to struggle. That means Republican money is going to have to put hundreds of millions of dollars into Texas. That could mean less money coming into North Carolina.
More to talk about with regard to the U.S. Senate race in North Carolina when we come back. Also, some House races to hit on in the county commission and the sheriff's race, which is probably the hottest race here in Mecklenburg County. We'll get to them in Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. CharlotteTalks.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the primaries. The early voting is underway through February 28th with Election Day on March 3rd. Steve Harrison is with us. He's WFAE's political reporter, as is Colin Campbell. Well, he's not with us, but he's with WUNC, a fellow public radio guy, Capitol Bureau Chief and political reporter for that station. You answered almost all of my questions, Colin, about the Senate race with your first answer. but let me come up with a new question, because we've got Democratic, the front runner on the Democratic side, the former governor, Roy Cooper, on the Republican side, the former head of the RNC, Michael Whatley, who, as you say, hails from the Gastonia area. Michael Whatley has the Trump endorsement, and in a recent report that you did on this race, you point out that Trump said on Truth Social that Whatley, quote, is one of the most capable executives in our country. So he does have some very conservative people running against him. Is that endorsement, the Trump endorsement, likely to have the impact on Republican voters that could squash any challenge?
I think that's still the deciding factor in a race like this, particularly one where Whatley isn't all that well known. So the Trump endorsement really is sort of what is going to stick out to Republican voters about him. What I think will be really interesting to watch in this race is what percentage of the vote does he actually get? He's pretty certain to win, but does he win with 55% of the vote and then the other challengers that I mentioned earlier split the rest of it? Or does he, you know, get 70 or 80% with that Trump endorsement? I think if it's lower than 70 or 80% with a Trump endorsement in a Republican primary, that tells you the value of a Trump endorsement for a candidate who isn't all that well known by the overall electorate, doesn't have quite maybe the value that it did a few years ago. So that's sort of the key element of that Trump endorsement I'm watching, to see just how much power does it have for Michael Whatley, who a lot of the polling showed, you know, when he entered the race, even though he'd run the North Carolina Republican Party for a number of years, he'd run the Republican National Committee, he hasn't run for office before, so a lot of voters just didn't really know who he was.
And we also have this environment where there are a lot of very, very angry Democrats out there about what's going on, particularly nationally, as a result of the first year of the Trump presidency. Trump has historically unpopular ratings in the polls, and some of that is involved in the fact that his approach to immigration change and rounding up immigrants and the way those immigrants and alleged immigrants and some American citizens have been handled in cities like Chicago and Minneapolis particularly, but also here in Charlotte, also up in Wake County, because Border Patrol was there for a while. So, Steve, does that mean that in the fall that the Trump endorsement might backfire on the Republican candidate for governor?
I think it will be interesting to watch this race unfold. I mean, right now, Michael Whatley is up on TV with a biographical commercial kind of introducing himself to voters, because a lot of people don't really know who he is. And the commercial, of course, closes with him and President Trump, because as Colin said, in a Republican primary, that's absolutely critical. I think it will be interesting to see if there's any other path Michael Whatley can take as we go into the summer and the fall, whether there's any distance he tries to put between himself and the president, or at least the president's more unpopular policies. I'm not really sure that that's a lane for him. I don't know if there's any path, a non-Trump path, or even a partially non-Trump path. I don't know if that exists for Michael Whatley.
Of course, nationally, Democrats are hoping to flip the House to their side, and they're hoping, although it's going to be a little tougher, to flip the United States Senate. But if Roy Cooper wins in November, how important will that be to those Democratic efforts? If a Democrat takes the Senate seat in our state, would that be because the tide has turned nationally and therefore they'll take the Senate, or will that just be an outlier race, Steve?
I think it, when Democrats look for the four that they need to win, it's what, 53-47? I think North Carolina is at really the near the top of their wish list or expected gains, you know, what they think are their best chances to flip a seat. So if Roy Cooper wins, I don't think that necessarily means the Democrats are going to take the U.S. Senate. I think if he doesn't win, then it's almost certain they won't, if that makes sense.
Okay, yeah, it does. So let's move on to some of the House races. Much has been made of the state's largest latest gerrymander, I should say, that has changed the makeup, particularly of District 1. This is outside of WFAE's listening area, but the current occupant of that state is Democrat Don Davis. He ended up not living in the district that is now District 1, but he's decided to run anyway. He has no Democratic competition in that primary. Historically, District 1 has not had a Republican occupant of that seat since 1883. But there is a Republican primary in that district pitting Army veteran Laurie Buckout against Bobby Hoenig, if that's how you say his name. Colin, that's your neck of the woods. So who's the favorite in that Republican primary?
You know, we talked earlier about the Trump endorsement having a factor. This is going to be an interesting one to watch because there's no Trump endorsement. The president has not weighed in support of any of these candidates, and there's several. There's the ones you've mentioned. There's the sheriff of Carteret County, Asa Buck, is running. County commissioner from Lenoir County, which is down in the eastern side of the state, and it isn't even in the district. He's running in this race. We've got, a divorce attorney as well. So a lot of people who are really trying hard to tie themselves to Trump, but don't actually have a Trump endorsement. So this is going to be an interesting one to watch to see who comes out of a multi-candidate race. And is it someone who is going to have a good shot at defeating an incumbent, even in a district that has been redrawn to significantly favor Republicans? If Republicans end up nominating someone who turns out by the time we get to November is somewhat of a weak candidate, that maybe gets Congressman Don Davis, the Democrat, to pull off an upset that allows him to keep that seat and keep the state's congressional delegation in its current configuration, as opposed to Republicans getting one more seat out of North Carolina, which is the goal of the gerrymander.
Army vet Laurie Buckout has had some health problems and withdrew from politics for a while, but got back into this as she narrowly lost against the current incumbent of that seat, Mr. Davis, 2 years ago. If this is a rematch between her and Davis in November, do you see what do you see as his chances of retaining that seat? And if he does retain it, does that lend credence to the theory that some predictions that GOP attempts to gerrymander their way into office here and elsewhere in the country are backfiring?
I think that's a possibility. It could be a really good year for Democrats, and the nature of this district under its new lines still could be such that Don Davis is defeated. I mean, Laurie Buckout, who you mentioned, has a lot of money behind her. She's done this race before. She's worked in the Trump administration, and even in the primary, there's some outside PACs and other groups that are spending money on ads in support of her. So certainly, you know, she's got a decent shot at this if she gets through. Don Davis has outperformed his party before, so that's a factor in this that he could do well. So there's a certain level of benefit you get from being an incumbent member of Congress. You do the constituent service. You sort of endear yourselves to people who may not align with you politically, and that can help. But certainly the odds are stacked against Davis in this race. But if he wins, that shows, you know, one, he's, you know, managed to win over some people in the middle, but two, that it's a really good year for Democrats in November if he's able to retain that seat.
So closer to home, Steve, are there congressional races in our area that you are particularly focused on, interested in?
I will say in the immediate Charlotte area, it is a total zero in terms of competitive primaries. I mean, you know, Alma Adams, the Democratic representative from Mecklenburg County, will win easily. The Republicans who surround Mecklenburg are going to be heavily favored. Tim Moore, Mark Harris, Pat Harrigan. I do think there is an interesting race in the mountains in the 11th district. We talked about, can Don Davis hold on to his seat in the first? The 11th is kind of the other Democrats' other possibility to pick up a seat, because that is a Trump plus nine seat, roughly. Jamie Ager is the Democrat favored to win the primary, and he would go against Chuck Edwards. So that's one. The mountains is an area that has been trending slightly Democratic in recent years. So if there is a big enough blue wave, that is one to watch.
So the current makeup of North Carolina's congressional delegation in the House is a 10-4 split, 10 Republicans, 4 Democrats. With the redraw that was asked for by the president, it would end up being 11-3 if all things go the way the Republicans would like them to go. But is that an impenetrable strategy, Colin? Or could Democrats, given the current crop of candidates they're feeling and fielding rather and the zeitgeist in the nation actually maintain or improve upon their current ratio in North Carolina?
I think it would take a really good year for Democrats to be able to pull that off, but I don't think it's impossible. And what's interesting is that, you know, you have the two races we mentioned. So there's even a possibility, however slight, that if Republicans were able to keep or weren't not able to win against Don Davis, they weren't able to keep Chuck Edwards as the congressman from the western corner of the state, you could see Democrats even maybe picking up a seat. And certainly Democrats are even contesting some of the other ones that are more of a even stronger gerrymander in favor of Republicans. They still have candidates on the ballot. And so there's still maybe room for an upset in some of these places. I think it would take a lot to get there, but it's not completely impossible.
Steve, we re-gerrymandered because we did it in between the census at the behest of Donald Trump. The state of Texas did it. There are other states, Republican-controlled states, who did it. Of course, California answered with a re-gerrymandering of their own to favor Democrats. Other states have done something similar to that. When is this musical chair game going to end?
That's a good question. I think what's interesting about this mid-decade redistricting, you know, as you said, Texas started it, and the Democrats have really fought Republicans to a draw. I mean, they have countered, as you said, California, Virginia recently passed a new map. I think the Maryland map gives the Democrats a chance to pick up one. So when you look at the nation as a whole, I don't think either side is going to come. I think that the Democrats were able to counter this Republican push to try and hold the House. And so I don't think either side is going to go into November with a particularly more favorable national map than they had 2 years ago. Now, in terms of when it ends, I do not know.
So perhaps the highest profile race in our neck of the woods in Mecklenburg County outside of the gubernatorial primary is strictly on the Democratic side, where three people are challenging incumbent Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden for his job. There is no Republican in this race, so whoever wins this primary on March the 3rd will be the sheriff of Mecklenburg County at the end of the year. So given the controversy swirling around Gary McFadden, what impact, Steve, do you believe that will have on either voter turnout or the outcome of this race?
So I don't think it matters much for turnout. I mean, I think turnout is all driven by President Trump and how people feel about him. But I do think that when people get into the ballot, you know, in the Democratic ballot, I feel like all of the headlines about Sheriff McFadden, people are aware of this race. I mean, I think they do, you know, in a much more than a normal election, they are aware of the controversy. They are aware of who he is and his challengers. You know, Charlotte Mecklenburg or CMPD Sergeant Ricky Robbins, one of the three challengers, appears to be the candidate that is the most likely alternative to the sheriff. He's raised the most money, has the most high profile endorsements. But I think it will be interesting, Mike. You know, we had a couple of weeks ago that big high profile hearing in Raleigh about crime in Charlotte when Sheriff McFadden was grilled by Republicans and he struggled to name the three branches of government, et cetera. If that were a general election and they were a Republican candidate, that would certainly hurt him. As for a Democratic primary, I don't know what the impact will have. I mean, I think there would be a fair number of voters who were going to who could arguably rally to his side.
And, I mean, I guess yeah. People are paying attention to the controversy. We are, because it's our job to pay attention to it. But I don't know whether it's hitting home with a lot of voters. But if it is, would that be enough in some cases for independents to choose to vote in the Democratic primary over the Republican primary simply for a chance to vote in this race?
Ooh, that is an interesting question. Perhaps. I think there will probably some who decide that they do want to weigh in on the sheriff's race or another local race. But I think the majority of unaffiliateds who decide to pick up a Democratic ballot, they're just doing it because of national politics. That's my guess.
All of the candidates in this Democratic primary are Black, all have law enforcement experience. Two worked either at the jail or in the sheriff's office. Another worked for CMPD. The Observer has endorsed, as you say, former CMPD officer Ricky Robinson, who has other high-profile endorsements, including that of the Panthers, because I believe he runs security or is part of security at the Panthers. The Black Political Caucus endorsed Gary McFadden. How much weight should we put on these endorsements?
Well, I think that in a Democratic primary in Mecklenburg County, the BPC endorsement is considered the most important. I mean, it's not impossible to win without it. We see every election or so that there are some candidates who win without the BPC. But I think it is the most important, probably in this primary, roughly half of the voters will be African-American. The Charlotte Observer endorsement, probably if we go back to 2004, that would probably be the gold standard. But, you know, I mean, just the reach of newspapers and media, it's not what it was. So I do think that the BPC is a big coup for the sheriff.
So the winner of this primary, as I said, will be the winner in November. There is no Republican running. WFAE spoke with Ricky Robbins and Rodney Collins several weeks ago in a candidate forum. Sheriff McFadden was out of town and unavailable, and Antoine Nance, the fourth candidate in the race, was a no-show. But you can hear that conversation on our website at WFAE.org. You can do it before you vote. One of the key statehouse races to watch is District 106 in Mecklenburg County, Steve, where Democrat Carla Cunningham is facing fellow Democrat Reverend Rodney Sadler and someone who ran against Cunningham last time and lost, Romano Bowman. Cunningham has the most conservative voting record among Democrats in the state house. She sided with Republicans on several key votes and got herself into a bit of a controversy over comments that she made and later apologized for about immigrant assimilation, which is the easiest way to put it, I guess. Is that shaping up to be a difficult contest for her?
Yeah, I think absolutely. Rodney Sadler has raised, the last I heard, more than $100,000. That is a significant amount for a state house race. Governor Josh Stein has come off the sidelines to endorse him. So this race has really, Representative Cunningham had voted with Republicans before in past sessions, occasionally to override vetoes. That wasn't new. But Mike, like you said, it was the speech she gave on the House floor when she talked about defending her vote. It was a bill to require sheriffs to work more closely with ICE. And in her speech, she said, you know, all cultures are not equal. Immigrants need to assimilate, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that may not have been particularly controversial 30 years ago, but in 2025, it was a very, very big deal. And that really, that speech put her, it just put her race on a whole different level of attention and scrutiny.
As you say, she has Governor Josh Stein's endorsement. I want to talk. She does not, excuse me. Rodney Sadler has Governor Josh Stein's endorsement. I want to come back and talk a little bit about that, and we'll move on to some other district races, the state senate, and the county commission here in Mecklenburg County. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. It's primary season. The early voting is underway. It goes through February 28th. You can look up where to go on the websites that are all available, including ours as well. And, of course, Election Day is March 3rd. We're talking about all this with Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter, and Colin Campbell, who is the Capitol Bureau Chief and political reporter for WUNC. Before we move on from the statehouse race involving Carla Cunningham, Governor Josh Stein, as you mentioned, Steve, endorsed Rodney Sadler in this race. Is that a reflection of the fact that she helped override one of his vetoes, or is it a reflection of how most Democrats feel about her?
I think it's a little bit of both, but especially the latter, because in Mecklenburg County, we have another House race competitive with Nassif Majid, who also voted last year to override one of Governor Stein's vetoes. He did it very quietly, did not give a speech on the House floor. He just did it. This was a veto, one of the bills that defined in North Carolina that there are two sexes and genders, male and female. Stein has not endorsed his opponent, Valeria Levy. And so this isn't all just about party discipline and support of the governor. He came off the sidelines against Carla Cunningham, I think because of that speech and just the attention that drew.
Well, there has been, as you mentioned, some Democratic backlash against Nassif Majid, who represents District 99, which covers parts of northeast Charlotte, the University City area, Hidden Valley. As you say, he broke with Democrats on overriding a gubernatorial veto. He's up against Valeria Levy and a college student by the name of Tucker Neal. Political scientist Chris Cooper from Western Carolina University points to this primary and the one involving Cunningham as a kind of litmus test to see the degree to which the Democratic Party can enforce party orthodoxy on its members. Are voters, however, clued in to any or all of that?
I think voters will definitely be, are definitely going to be clued in and aware in the Carla Cunningham, Rodley Sadler race. I mean, I think that that's just received so much attention. And Mike, it was interesting. You talked about this party discipline, party purity. The state Democratic Party is withheld vote builder, like a software that helps you identify volunteers and likely voters. They withheld it from those two and a few other Democrats who have voted to override vetoes. And I believe, Colin, I mean, jump in if I'm wrong, I believe Governor Stein was asked about that, and he did not agree with that decision to withhold the software. And it's just a very interesting, like, intra-party intra-Democratic Party dynamics.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, one of those ones where the parties are definitely the people who are paying attention day-to-day to who gets access to the software. But I think in general, the average voter is probably more interested in the issues, which that's why I think the Carla Cunningham race is so interesting, because it plays into all these issues around immigration, ICE cooperation, which of course is super relevant in Charlotte after the ICE and Border Patrol actions last year. That seems to have a little bit more staying power than just the did you toe the party line argument that some folks are looking at and how they approach these candidates.
And Dr. Chris Cooper goes on to say that for Nassif Majid to lose, his challengers will have to do a great job of educating voters about what Democratic leadership views as his missteps. How would you rate their attempts to do that, if any, Steve?
I do know that the amount of money in that race that Valeria Levy has been able to raise is just far, far less than Rodney Sadler. So it's going to be harder for her to just get that message out. And in the in the Carla Cunningham race, there was an outside group that's put out a mailer that features Representative Cunningham with a red MAGA hat, pointing out, you know, that she votes with Republicans more than most. Yeah, I think it's, you know, the votes with Republicans more than any other Democrat. And so, you know, in this environment, a piece of mail like that has a big impact.
Let's talk about some party switchers, beginning with Tricia Cotham, because she narrowly survived a fight for re-election 2 years ago in the North Carolina House District 105, partly because she, in the previous election, was a Democrat, and she switched parties and gave temporarily the Republicans a supermajority. And a lot of Mecklenburg voters felt betrayed by that party switch from Democrat to Republican. Now she's in this Republican primary against Kelly Van Horn, who switched her party from Democrat to Republican to run in this primary. Do GOP voters see Van Horn as a wolf in sheep's clothing? Is this even remotely competitive, this primary?
I don't think the primary will be particularly competitive, no. And in terms of, I'm not even sure how many people, Mike, as you know, you use the term wolf in sheep's clothing. I'm not even sure how many people are aware of the party switch. I think just Republicans are going to go in the voting booth and know Tricia Cotham. And they're not going to know the other person. And I mean, and that's what's going to decide this race.
There are two party switchers who have gone from Democrat to Republican, allegedly, and maybe they truly have switched parties. Maybe they haven't. It's hard to tell, Colin, but the Republican Party is pointing them out. There's an article in the paper this morning about this. What are they doing?
So I think the Republican Party is worried that, you know, if we talked about turnout earlier this show, kind of low on the Republican side. You get low turnout. Sometimes you get some weird surprises. Sometimes you get people who are going to the voting booth and just picking a name and they don't necessarily know. So I think the Republican Party is trying to be proactive about some of these party switchers, these people who, and you see this around the state, not just in the Tricia Cotham race. There are a number of other races for state legislature where an organized group, mostly of educators, have sort of made the argument of, well, if it's a gerrymandered district, we're not going to win the general. The only way to maybe have a shot is in the primary, because that's when these things are getting decided. So they've switched parties to Republicans. A lot of them have said, no, my values haven't changed. I'm still, you know, supporting progressive issues. But I think Republicans are looking at that and thinking, this feels kind of deceptive, and we need to make sure that our voters, our actual conservative supporters, know what's going on here and don't think that, you know, these are actual Republican candidates running against the incumbent.
And I believe Kelly Van Horn is one of those educators, and one of the things that she has said is that she wants to promote better support for public education, something that has been weakened over the years, and I think intentionally, by Republicans, and certainly not helped by the adoption of these opportunity scholarships. But does that make her a Democrat? Could she actually be a Republican, but except for this one issue where she thinks the public schools ought to get more support?
I guess theoretically. I mean, there's, you know, more and more people now who don't necessarily align with the party on every single issue. But I think the way that parties enforce orthodoxy, as we were discussing with the Democrats earlier, it's very hard for someone who is only with that party on maybe one or two issues to get the kind of support that you need to get through a primary.
And Tricia Cotham, Steve, helped push the bill through the legislature that allowed us to hold the referendum on the sales tax for transit. She was a major player in that. Should she win the primary, she will face Ken McCool, a former Matthewstown commissioner. Matthews was opposed to the sales tax for transit vehemently because they're not getting the Silver Line train. If she wins this election, will the November be a cakewalk for her, or will it be difficult because of people in Matthews not voting for her?
It's going to be difficult either way. I mean, when she won re-election in 2024, it was only by 200 some odd votes. So this is a 50-50 seat. She's running again. So you get a couple more factors. You start with a 50-50 seat. You go into November with what's going to be a hard environment for Republicans. That's a problem. And then the second problem, Mike, like you said, in terms of this hyper-local issue of the transit tax, and Matthews is a huge part of her district. And a lot of people, I think people in Matthews voted against the tax, roughly 65% against. So, you know, that she's going to be, that will probably cost her that tax, maybe 100, 150, 200, 300 votes. I mean, it's not a huge number, but in a race like this, it does count.
Colin, one of the top primary races to watch is another one not in our listening area. It's Senate District 26. The Republican primary is a face-off between Senate Pro Tem Leader Phil Berger, who's been in the Senate forever, and Rockingham Sheriff Sam Page. Berger has not had a primary challenger, I understand it, since 2012. Why now?
So this is an interesting one. Sam Page's opposition to Phil Berger, both Page has been the sheriff for over 20 years. Berger's been the senator from this area, which is basically Greensboro north to the Virginia border for 20 years. And he's been in the leadership role for the past 15, essentially the most powerful politician in the state. But a couple of years ago, he pushed a plan to add casinos, including one that was in his district. There was another one proposed for Y'all's region down in Charlotte area in Anson County. And that put created a lot of local backlash from people who did not want to see casino gambling come to their community. And that sort of created this groundswell of some grassroots Republicans in Berger's district who felt like he was out of touch, has, you know, caved to special interest, and that they want a new leadership for that area. But a loss for Phil Berger in this race would be a statewide political earthquake. It would not just affect that district. It would really change the balance of power in Raleigh.
Yeah, that's my question. How would it change the balance of power? What would happen if he were to lose?
Well, we know we're in the legislature. We're currently in this budget stalemate where Berger is pushing to keep scheduled income tax cuts from changing. House Republicans want to revise those, recognizing that the revenue is not going to be where it needs to be if you have these kind of tax cuts. Berger, because he has sort of a stranglehold over power in the Senate, all the other Republican senators vote with him, has the power to sort of shape this debate and keep the stalemate going. If he loses his power and becomes a lame duck, then all bets are off. The political dynamics and power dynamics change.
Does he have an heir apparent, or would it be a free-for-all?
There's a couple folks who might step into that role. I've heard Todd Johnson from Union County mentioned. I've heard Michael Lee, senator from the Wilmington area, mentioned. But there's not. It would definitely be a contested race to replace him. It would not be Sam Page, the guy who's running against him. It would be someone with some seniority. But certainly, I think allows individual senators on the Republican side to be a little bit more independent, at least in the short term, because they don't have sort of a powerful political boss leading their caucus that they don't necessarily want to go against their policies.
And Steve, if I'm right about this, there's only one state Senate race in Mecklenburg. It's District 37. It's a Democratic primary between Reagan Angel and Prasinda Bjorgan. The winner will face Republican incumbent Vicky Sawyer in November. What can you tell us about that primary and the chances that the winner of the Democratic primary would have any success going up against Vicky Sawyer?
This is a very Vicky Sawyer will be the overwhelming favorite in this race. The district, the Senate district, is almost all of it's all of Iredell County plus a small portion of North Mecklenburg. So Vicky Sawyer won easily last time and will be heavily favored again.
And when it comes to the Mecklenburg County Commission, North Mecklenburg seems to be the epicenter of the action in the races for the County Commission. District 1's Elaine Powell is not running for re-election. Who is seeking the Democratic nomination in that race? And is there a Republican in the race?
There are three Democrats running. Jessica Finkel, Morris McAdoo, and Adam Pasaic are all in the race. Like you said, it's an open seat, which is a great opportunity for people to jump in. So that's going to be one to watch. And then the another district race that's going to be fascinating is Vilma Leake's seat. Commissioner Leake has held that seat since 2008, and she is running against is being challenged by Manifa Drayton, a political longtime political consultant. Leake has drawn opponents before and has always held them off. So, but that'll be a fun race to watch next month.
And again, WFAE and the League of Women Voters Charlotte Mecklenburg had a recent candidate forum with all the candidates running for Mecklenburg County Commission at large and for districts 1, 2, and 3. And you can hear that forum at our website at WFAE.org. Colin, one of the most significant races this year, I guess among them, would be the seat for the state Supreme Court. The Democrat and Republican primaries in that race were both canceled. Why?
So this was an interesting one. Normally, you get a lot of candidates in the primary, both on the Democratic and Republican side. No, only one candidate filed. Anita Earls, who's the incumbent, who's the Democrat on the Supreme Court. She has no Democratic opponents. On the Republican side, Representative Sarah Stevens, who served in the state house from the Mount Airy area for a while, is sort of the anointed candidate on that, and no other Republicans jumped in there. So we won't see that on the ballot, which means both of these candidates are already looking towards the general election. I saw some recent reporting that Anita Earls had massively out-fundraised Sarah Stevens. So certainly a lot of energy towards getting Anita Earls reelected to the Supreme Court. It's not going to change the balance of power on the Supreme Court. Still going to be a Republican majority. But certainly, if Democrats want to have a chance in 2028 of taking back a majority on the Supreme Court, they've got to hold this Anita Earls seat.
Yeah, if Anita Earls wins, the balance stays 5-2 Republican Democrat. If she loses, it'll be 6-1. I would think that both parties see this as critical, particularly the Democratic Party. Could we see a repeat, however, of the never-ending vote challenging that we saw in the Supreme Court race between Allison Riggs, who was also a Democratic incumbent, and her challenger, Jefferson Griffin, or have they learned their lesson?
I think that's a playbook that may get tried again, and maybe in a different legal landscape, different judges, different courts might have more of a successful path. But I think we're at a point in politics now, whether it's this race or the U.S. Senate race or any other race up and down the ballot. If it's really close, we're going to have a long, drawn-out battle where individual votes are being challenged, lots of complaints are being lodged, and it takes us quite some time after November before we really know who the winner is.
We've heard Donald Trump talk about the need to federalize elections and make Republicans in charge of elections. And we've heard, I guess, second guessing about whether or not there will be troops involved in the general election in November and whether he will, in fact, accept the outcome in November if it doesn't go the Republicans' way. That aside, however, early voting is underway now in this primary. It goes till February 28th, Election Day, March 3rd. Steve, what do voters need to know? What do they need to bring with them to the polls? What form of ID is acceptable? How long can you register to vote?
I will address the ID issue. Photo ID is required in North Carolina, but the key thing is if you go to the polls and you forget your ID, you leave it at home, you can fill out a photo ID impediment form, and you get to click a box as to why you don't have your ID. If you fill out the form correctly, past elections have shown your ballot is almost always counted. So photo ID is not a reason. Not having it with you is not a reason not to go vote.
So we know the margins are going to be thin, despite the fact that we have a lot of heavy voting in certain areas. But we know that elections matter, and when margins are thin, your vote really counts. So vote. Steve Harrison, our political reporter at WFAE News. Colin Campbell, Capitol Bureau Chief and political reporter for WUNC. Thank you both for the hour.
Thanks, Mike.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.